Okay, here we are back for episode 124. Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. It's so good to hear your booming voice.
Loud and clear?
Yes, you are.
Okay, well, tonight we agreed to talk about the report from Iron Mountain. The report from Iron Mountain is a book published in 1967 during the LBJ administration by Dial Press, which puts itself forth as a report of a government panel. The book includes the claim that it was authored by a special study group of 15 men whose identities were to remain secret and that it was not intended to be made public. It details the analysis of a government panel which concludes that war or a credible substitute for war is necessary if governments are to maintain power. The book was a New York Times bestseller and has been translated into 15 languages. Controversy still swirls over whether the book was a satiric hoax about think tank logic and writing style or the product of a secret government panel. The document is a favorite among conspiracy theorists to reject the statement made in 1972 by satirist Leonard Lewin that the book was a spoof and that he was its author. Liberty Lobby put out an edition around 1990 claiming that it was a U.S. government document and therefore inherently in the public domain. Lewin sued them for copyright infringement, which resulted in a settlement. According to the New York Times, neither side would reveal the full amount of the settlement, but Lewin received more than 1,000 copies of the bootleg version. According to the report, a 15-member panel was set up in 1963 to examine what problems would occur if the United States entered a state of lasting peace. They met at an underground nuclear bunker called Iron Mountain, and as well as other locations, reportedly, and worked over the next 2 years. A member of the panel, one John Doe, a professor at a college in the Midwest, decided to release the report to the public. The heavily footnoted report concluded that peace was not in the interest of a stable society, that even if lasting peace could be achieved, it would be almost certainly not to be in the best interest of society to achieve it. War was a part of the economy. Therefore, it was necessary to conceive a state of war for a stable economy. The government, the group theorized, would not exist without war, and nation-states existed in order to wage war. War served the vital function of diverting collective aggression. They recommended credible substitutes and paying a blood price to emulate the economic functions of war. Prospective government devised alternatives to war included reports of alien life forms, the reintroduction of a euphemized form of slavery consistent with modern technology and political processes, and one deemed particularly promising in gaining the attention of the malleable masses was the threat of gross pollution of the environment. U.S. News and World Report claimed in its November 20th, 1967 issue to have confirmed the reality of the report from an unnamed government official, who added that when President Johnson read the report, he hit the roof and ordered it to be suppressed for all time. When it was first published, controversy surrounded the book over the question of its authenticity. On March 19, 1972, edition of the New York Times Book Review, Lewin said that he had written the book. The book was listed in the Guinness Book of World Records as the most successful literary hoax. Some people claim the book is genuine and has only been called a hoax as a means of damage control. Purported statements made by John Kenneth Galbraith in support of its authenticity. He said, on November 26, 1967, the report was reviewed in the book section of the Washington Post by Herschel McLandris, supposedly a pen name for the Harvard professor. John Kenneth Galbraith, McLandris wrote that he knew firsthand of the report's authenticity because he had been invited to participate in its creation, that although he was unable to be part of the official group, he was consulted from time to time and had been asked to keep the project secret, and that while he doubted the wisdom of letting the public know about the report, he agreed totally with its conclusion. He wrote, As I would put my personal repute behind the authenticity of this document, so I testify to the validity of its conclusions. My reservations relates only to the wisdom of releasing it to an obviously unconditioned public. The report itself states, from a historical perspective, war has been the only reliable way for a government to perpetuate itself. Fear of an enemy will cause civilians to accept government intrusion into their lives. Also, war creates loyalty for political leaders, but during times of peace, people begin to turn against taxes and intrusion. The report states, the war system not only has been essential to the existence of a nation as independent political entities, but also as equally indispensable to the stable internal political structure. Without it, no government has ever been able to obtain acquiescence in its legitimacy or right to rule its society. The possibility of war provides a sense of external necessity, without which no government can long remain in power. The historic record reveals one instance after another where the failure of a regime to maintain the credibility of a war threat led to its dissolution by the forces of private interest, of reactions to social injustice, or other disintegrative elements. That's from the report. The report then sought to find a substitute, credible substitute for war, crises, fear, that sort of thing. Well, like I said, this report, very controversial. Some say that even if it is a hoax, it's important because it reveals certain truths about the system itself. So it's whether it's really authentic or not, it does reflect the reality of the system. And we could talk about, whether it's whether it is satire, because satire only has, I guess, resonance because satire makes fun of what's true, so it's a slight exaggeration. We can point out things like the fact that the military Keynesianism, as foreseen in a National Security Council Memorandum 68, which was a secret government document which called for a perpetual preparedness or large military spending to maintain economic stability and these things. So this type of thinking predates the report and also the alleged meeting. So that's the report from Iron Mountain. We can talk about its controversy, its meaning, and its importance. So, Joe, what do you have to say?
Gee, first of all, I think that it doesn't really function as a satire. I don't think that it is some government document that was somehow, supposedly the Pentagon Papers, were uncovered. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that, because this isn't the kind of ideas and thought world that the secret society that runs the government, or even the think tanks that they organize, like RAND Corporation. Most of these things that they're concluding are not really, they don't really have any contestation. I mean, they're just self-evidence. Why would they need to have some kind of big secret document that's explaining that war is necessary for the functioning of the Masonic government? So it's like not exactly news, right? We've been at war ever since the country was started by the Masons, and they, this was right during the Vietnam War. So it's all that aspect of it, the idea of a rationale for war, is not something that you'd need to have a think tank to come up with this idea. They're obviously well aware of it. And then as a satire, then what is it making fun of? Who would, Lewin, the guy who supposedly wrote it, said that it was like he called it like a political satire sort of, but what's the point, right? Who would like look at this and then go, well, gee, I'm going to be a more, efficient citizen because there's some kind of hidden or revealed point here about the government with this sort of exaggeration, the satire. So I take a different perspective on it. I look at it basically in the same lineage as Brave New World or 1984, which is to say it primarily functions as a kind of a declaration and a humor document for the oligarchs. And that's why it's so prescient. That's why in 1967, it was able to talk about we need to have a gigantic world pollution that we can organize, the public around through fear. We need to have, extraterrestrial menace, right? The idea of that was part of one of the things he brought up. And then fictitious alternative enemies. Okay, so that's all, you know, I mean, you can see that this guy could see into the future really well. And he also talked about social control programs derived from the Peace Corps model, a modern sophisticated form of slavery. So that's very, very, you know, clear cut. I mean, this is someone who really does understand the workings of the secret society. Okay, that's how I look at this. Whoever authored this, I have no idea if Lewin was the author or not. You know, they have this cloud around the authorship. Whoever authored this certainly understood the future and the plan. You know, they talk, in fact, he talks about that we need, you know, this applied eugenics. I mean, think about Brave New World, think about the current autism program that the government runs. These things are, of course, you know, applied eugenics, and you know, it just adds to the whole prescient awareness that that whoever created this thing had. You know, so I would put it in that category, that this is really just like a foreshadowing. It's really done just for two purposes. I think it really makes the oligarchs who are aware of what the program is just laugh. This is kind of a way that they can mock the stupidity of the people who are being controlled, right? Because here it is right in their face, and they don't even understand, you know, that this is literally it's being given to them as absurd, but they don't understand that this is exactly what's going on. And I think that that's actually kind of the mind control function of the thing. And this is where it gets kind of complicated, because you know, you get into like the effect of movies that talk about apocalypse, right? Like Dr. Strangelove or all the current zombie films. I think all of them have a kind of mind control purpose ultimately, right? They're just preparing us for the post-electric zombie apocalyptic world, like I live in here in Southern California. Where our electricity turns off anytime the wind blows, and so this is you know, these things normalize basically the process that the you know, the public is going through. So you have all these survivor shows where, you know, it's post-electric, everyone just groping around and you know, trying to eat on squirrels and things, and this just sort of normalizes. You know, and heroizes too, you know, what the future could be. Well, the report from Iron Mountain, I think, just kind of falls in that category. It's one of these things where it, you know, certainly to someone who's in the know, they would just laugh their ass off reading this thing. You know, the idea that the public couldn't see how real this all was. But also it functions on the public as just, even though it you know, purports to be satire, it also normalizes these ideas. It just sort of, you know, kind of just discussing them in a kind of this objective, cold, calculating manner makes it more, you know, I think just more easy for these processes to not be rebelled against. So this is kind of my take on it, is that it's you know, it's very evil. The people who, you know, there's like a kind of the right wing have adopted it, at least according to the media. Now, how accurate is this? I don't know. But they claim that there are right wingers who sort of see this as Agenda 21, you know, being identified, and they therefore say this is a real document. Well, I would say, and then of course, then they are ridiculed, right? The people who come forward with this idea, because they go, look, these people are so stupid, they don't even recognize that this is a 100% vetted satire. It's fiction. It didn't come from the government, right? So this is, you can see how it functions in a kind of an alchemical way there, because it gives them a way to expose, you know, the nature of the kind of the far right, to use an expression.
It's kind of like the protocols of the Elders of Zion, right? Where's the lie?
Exactly. And now the protocols of the Elders of Zion, which I think this would fit into the same that into that genre.
Which Alan Dulles debunked, I think.
Well, right, exactly. Now, the nature of the claim about the protocols is that you know, they discovered like the documents that it was based upon, and therefore people who believe it are exposed as crackpots, right? Because they believe this very complicated, very specifically written document because it's been debunked. Now, very seldom does anyone like make the claim, well, actually, the idea that it's been debunked is somewhat diminished by the fact that Alan Dulles was the individual who found the documents that did it. This is a little far-fetched, but this rarely gets, you know, into press, and they use it basically as a way to show that kind of the accusation against undemocratic power in the hands of Jewish people is basically, look, it's anti-Semitism. It's like the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Well, the report from Iron Mountain gets used in the same way. I mean, I've actually seen some cases, you know, looking at some of the internet stuff where people will point out the people who believe it's real and therefore are resisting, you know, Agenda 21, because Agenda 21 they see is, you know, carrying out this thing, see they're crackpots because they can't even see satire. So there is this like really complicated kind of mind control alchemical aspect of all of this literature, from, you know, Brave New World, 1984, Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the report from Iron Mountain, Dr. Strangelove. I mean, they all kind of work in the same way against, to use an expression, the Gentile mind. You see, people who look at these things kind of, you know, are less able to understand that a process is being established by which, you know, there is like a kind of a technologic dictatorship that's being established, you know, because they see, you know, like in Brave New World, they think, well, gee, this is, you know, that we're being warned about it, you know, and so therefore we're able to rebel more efficiently or whatever. I don't know. But the thing is that all of these things just kind of work to me in the same way. They are foreshadowing. They normalize what is actually happening. They ridicule the public for the inability to see that these things are actually going on. And they're I think the easiest way to identify them is just by the fact that they all are very, very prescient. The fact that they can look so accurately into the future,
like H.G. Wells, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's my take, is that if you want to identify and kind of learn how to defeat them intellectually, you know, or at least it's not that let them damage you, is look for the prescient aspect. When they're extremely prescient, when they're very, very, you know, when they can see things like, using UFOs and world pollution as control systems. And this thing was written probably in 1965. I mean, that's just too prescient. That's probably someone who's really more likely in on the deal and understands the program going on than someone who's just, you know, drawing satire out of thin air.
Yeah, it's like H.G. Wells writing Shape of Things to Come.
Exactly.
Well, one thing that's interesting, your point is that these smoking gun documents that would be so nice if they existed, right? It makes it so simple, because then if you have these documents that are then proven hoaxes, whether it's the protocols or the Iron Mountain report, you point this out, and you also point out, you know, the evidence of that there is indeed a networking among certain social people of a social class, be it business or banking. And this elite class would network and organize and conspire, if you will, against the public in order to maintain their dominance. Same thing with the protocols, the fact that there'd be, you know, ethno-religious group that was well-organized and concentrated and, or, you know, networked throughout the world, this diaspora that would network for their own benefit. And, you know, they would engage in things, you know, whether it's, you know, all the nefarious activities that we've talked about among, you know, by organized Jewry around the world and throughout history. If you point these historical facts of these things, they immediately call you a crackpot and anti-Semite because the protocols have been debunked. It's an interesting trick, you know. I've read bits and pieces. I never read the entire report itself, but I read large portions of it, and it's all spelled out for you. I mean, wouldn't it be nice? I'm reminded of when I was reading it is a plan that's being laid out by the technocracy, and it reminds me of the. In 1982, when Norman Dodd, who was the investigator for the Reese Committee, who was, it was sort of a good faith investigation of the power of the foundations. And this, the, that investigation, I think, started peeking into the very the groups of, the group that this the report Iron Mountain was talking about, who's laying out this plan. But he was interviewed, I think, by G. Everett Griffin. But in that interview, he provided a startling revelation of the minutes of the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. And this dates back to the early part of the 20th century. I think it was her, his investigator, Catherine Casey, who unearthed this when she went up to read the minutes of the foundation. But he wrote, or at least he said in the interview, "We are at the year 1908, which was the year that Carnegie began operations. And in that year, the trustees meeting for the first time raised a specific question. They discussed throughout the balance of the year in a very learned fashion. And the question is there any means known for more effective than war, assuming you wish to alter the life of any of an entire people? They conclude that no more effective means than war to that end is known to humanity." And then, of course, the 20th century unfolded the way it did. And that's where you haven't seen peace in the last century, right? So it's what the report, you know, what the report from Iron Mountain laid out was something that, you know, there's already been evidence for. It's just not written in a nice little book. But I thought Norman Dodd's revelations and the what the Reese Committee was getting into, of course, that investigation was then sort of shut down because they were getting into the foundations. And they're looking beyond communism. Remember, beginning of the investigation was they were looking into communist infiltration, I think the Institute for Pacific Affairs or something.
I think Dodd was completely legitimate.
Yeah.
And I really think it's important to bring up his information. I think it was legitimate. And for one thing, it really shows the nefarious kind of nature of the foundations, which mm-hmm. is a valuable piece of information. But he brought it forward as, you know, as a new idea, basically, you mm-hmm. know, that, you know, war really is basically a social engineering tool of the oligarchs. And I think that was an important revelation. Then in 1966, following World War One and World War Two, probably less necessary because, well, we'd been at war for, you know, 60 years and we'd wiped out half of the European population. So, the idea that it functions as a satire, which is, as you know, the report on Iron Mountain is being given to us. Well, satire is a kind of humor, and humor is something that, you know, we really need to be very careful with. You know, you had mentioned Norm MacDonald, the former Saturday Night Live comic, mm-hmm. Making this strange joke about the nature of the German people, about how they, you know, are every like 40 years they want to try to rule the world.
Yeah, right? I mean, World War II, yeah, Hitler.
Yeah. And he goes, and you know, you never know, they might be trying it again. I forget the actual verbiage, but it was very, but if you look at how that humor operates and the purpose of it, it relies on an underlying assumption that has been conditioned, right? And the underlying assumption is that the Germans are warlike and evil, right? Which is, you know, in every Hollywood movie, this is brought up. And so when you laugh at MacDonald's joke, then the laughter is like it just like seals in the conditioned, the hopefully for the oligarchs conditioned concept. They're able to get, when you laugh, you now have just, you know, your very understanding unconsciously of the German people is basically that they are evil and warlike. So comedy is really, you know, it's a very, very, you know, you have to be very careful with it because it's the opposite of thought. Right. It's the exact opposite. It seals off the mind. It doesn't ever, in my opinion, produce the kind of the rational process. It stops the rational process from occurring. That's why I think comedy is so prevalent in our media, is that, I mean, MacDonald could say something like, well, we have to reevaluate our understanding of the German people based on the fact that the real Dr. Mengele was Ewan Cameron, the MKUltra psychiatrist, who made the declaration about the German people from his position of the president of the World Psychiatric, you know, Committee, whatever it is, and his ability to control the Nuremberg trials. So that would produce thinking and, you know, analytic process and research. You'd go back in and look up the facts and see if this was really true. But when he just uses the underlying assumption, which is the classic historical narrative, which unfortunately is a highly crafted piece of malevolent mind control, right? That's when we talk about history, what we're really talking about is a crafted mind control tool, right? We don't have any real history. It's nonsense. We don't have any. They've controlled the media, so what we have is comes through their filter, the pixelated reality, the books that they create. And so that's how why Norm MacDonald's comedy works, you know. And that's why when Cass Sunstein says that, you know, the alt media could end democracy, he was absolutely right. Because the so-called democracy is just an aspect of behavior that is derived from this crafted, malevolent, you know, propaganda tool that we call history. You know, and if you have too many people who lose touch with it and are more interested in an analytic and thinking kind of ways of understanding the world rather than just relying on, you know, yeah, vaccines are safe and effective based on everything I've read, you know, it's like, well, so there you have it. So that's why the report on Iron Mountain is, I think it's kind of interesting. I think people should, you know, spend some time with it because it, in my opinion, it's really just part of the, you know, the satire aspect of it is, you know, it's humor, but it's for the purpose of basically normalizing the process that it claims that it discovers and then winks saying, oh, it's not really real. We didn't really discover this, you know, that anyone who believes it is an idiot, you know, just don't take us seriously here. So, you know, the report on Iron Mountain, I mean, I wasn't aware of it. I'd heard of it, but I read it actually, which I wouldn't recommend. I mean, it's kind of dry. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's in this kind of like matter of fact, you know, kind of quasi think tank, you know, sort of verbiage and not very interesting. I just go straight to the conclusions at the end because that's where the meat of it is. That's where he talks about the new world that they're going to create. And you can see that this guy, whoever wrote this thing, is clearly in on the deal. You know, he's not a futurist and he doesn't see the future like amazingly well. He just knows what they're working on.
So. I think the important point is that, you know, they could write this satire report laying out the plan, you know, why obviously the plan's being implemented, you know, at the very time this book is being published and released and everyone's doubting its authenticity, not noticing that whether it's true or not, you know, the plan's being implemented, which is the important question, right? And that's the point. Yeah, it says, well, it's a hoax. Therefore, it's a hoax. Therefore, if you point out that, hey, this book, this, you know, particular piece of literature or book may be a hoax, but they're doing it, you know? And it's interesting that, you know, they could do all this throughout the, you know, the 20th century, you know, stoke the you know, get the country riled up, get them in these various wars, whether it's the Spanish-American War or the First World War, the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam, the Cold War, and all these you know, various crises, and have the people not notice, you know, not notice that you know they're that the elite is getting them into wars, you know, needless, senseless wars, so you know the nation's blood and treasure can be wasted to exhaust the people to make them more malleable and governable. And again, you can find disparate evidence for this, or disparate you know, writings or studies that show, you know, the various aspects of these plans being implemented, but no one sees it as one big plan. Whereas this book lays it as one big plan, but nevertheless, it's being implemented, and it is a mockery because reportedly we're a democratic republic, where the public relies on a free media to keep us well informed so we can elect our representatives who will exercise oversight over the various government agencies and departments that supposedly serve us, so, you know, provide national defense, security, domestic tranquility in these things. But then again, if indeed we're not well informed, our education system, our media does not provide us critical, you know, information that we can use to make critical decisions when we decide to vote, and how the pressure we put on our elected representatives, who are then supposed to control the various bureaucracies and agencies and bureaus and secret government agencies that we supposedly need. But that's not the truth, is it? The American people are constantly lied to, manipulated. It's psychological warfare 24/7. That's what the media is for. That's what mass media has developed as a science for the purposes of psychological warfare. I mean, for Pete's sake, the White House, I think it was C.D. Jackson, when he worked for the White House, the Eisenhower administration, worked for the psychological planning or warfare planning board or something.
Yeah, that's right.
What does that mean? They're not targeting our enemies, the Soviets. They're targeting, you know, the American people. And the fact that, again, that you would have to write a book and say, hey, this is what we're doing. Whereas you would think that if democracy functioned, and if the government was accountable to the people, and if the media and universities, education systems, experts, academics, were there actually keeping us well informed and holding these people accountable, these, you know, the elite accountable, government officials, the oligarchs accountable, then collectively people would have this understanding or consciousness. But the fact that they don't is an indictment of the entire system, because it's so darn obvious. But nevertheless, if you lay it out this way, you are a conspiracy nut, because it's been debunked as a hoax because someone wrote about it in a book, you know, 50 years ago.
Yeah, that's well said, Tim. That's exactly I agree completely. I mean, and, you know, the great tragedy of our world and our lives is that just the fact or the concept that all of the wars, you know, Napoleonic, Civil, Spanish American, I mean, there's some wars of legit conquest, I guess, but in large, the wars that march, you know, armies into one another and end up with, you know, millions of Europeans dead are just done to reduce European population. You know, that's all there is to it. That's why they exist. They are there to reduce population. And so once they get control of both sides, then they're able to march people in. I was reading about the Civil War. I hope we can do it as a subject at some point in the future. It's kind of complicated, but the Civil War, I was looking at the generals and just how the Freemasons were controlling absolutely both sides of the battlefield. Gettysburg, the three Southern generals that were, you know, pushing the Southern troops forward into the mill, where they're all just being extinguished. They're all Freemasons from like one lodge. And then on the other side, the Union generals were all Masons as well. So it was just a Freemasonic bloodbath, right, of like basically the will of the oligarchs was being expressed in the obedience, the authority structure that had been created in the military to get these people to walk into automatic weapon fire, you know, which then was expanded in World War II and then actually used against, you know, World War I, and then in World War II, they just used technology to wipe out civilian populations everywhere, you know. And so this is the no joke, no satire reality that we have to overcome in our world. And every aspect has been weaponized. You know, the financial world is, you know, basically a weapon. The idea that we're given this idea that there's these free markets, and yet the Federal Reserve is, you know, I mean, it's obviously, you know, just it has no control over it and can make billionaires out of anyone it chooses. So, you know, there's no real market here. It never has been, at least certainly not since Federal Reserve came into existence. And so, and then, of course, history. And as you point out, the media, you know, it's just astonishing to me that they're able to control the media to the extent that, for example, 911 isn't, you know, being analyzed accurately, right? Or even at all, right? They they talk about there's just been very, very few moments when the truth movement ever had even a chance to get some, kind of notice. And yet there's so much evidence that you'd think this should, that the media would be in all over it every single day, but they never are, because it's a controlled device, right? So the report from Iron Mountain is interesting. I think the guys in the far right, I wouldn't be surprised if some of them are just government shills, you know, who just come forward saying, hey, I believe it, it's real. And then they're used to basically set up the right wing or the alt media as buffoons and conspiracy theorists. If you ever get a chance, I don't even know if it's still on YouTube. I wouldn't be surprised if it's been taken off. But there was an interview, incredibly, between Alex Jones and David Rothschild. And have you ever seen it?
No, is he the guy that sails around the world now?
Yeah, he's
the young guy,
eco kind of warrior type guy. He is the kind of the heir to the whole deal. He's the would be the one that would be the most powerful of this generation. So he's very, he's obviously, one of the world's real oligarchs. And this was when Alex Jones was just starting out. The idea that you could get someone who is so unapproachable, right, as a guest is just ludicrous. And Jones is berating him. He's yelling at him, going, I won't be your slave, Rothschild. You know, he's just over. I won't be your slave. And Rothschild is just the sweetest kind of kind-hearted, clear-minded person. Go, well, for heaven's sakes, I'm not asking you to be a slave. I just, so it was just clearly just kind of a comic setup, but it indicated that Jones had to have been, somehow he's like controlled opposition. Now, you could never get a, person like that to be on the show if he didn't have access into that kind of level. And so this, when I saw that, I knew that, you have agents, people who are one way or another manipulated or just outright lifetime actors that are in the alt media to basically make it harder for people to, get their way through.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's whenever, if I'm talking about something like this, whether it's conspiracy or talk about the ruling elite or the nature of these wars or the corruption of government, you'll often hear someone who really doesn't know much about the alternative media go, you sound like Alex Jones.
Yeah. Because they've created the icon so they can use it as a tool, And so this is, it makes it a lot more difficult, to use the internet to set up rebellion. And I was going through the Iron Mountain thing. I was
thinking, you mentioned slavery. And sorry to cut you off.
But, no, please.
Talking about what new sophisticated forms of slavery?
Yeah.
Well, isn't that what usury is all about, and central banking and paper currency and? Sure. I mean, I was listening to a talk. I think it was Catherine Austin Fitz was talking about how this entire system they create these multitudes of bureaucracies and red tape that we all have to comply with. But the elite don't have to comply with it. I mean, I'd reckon to say that someone like the Rothschilds don't even have driver's licenses, right?
Yeah.
They probably don't even have passports. They probably can, skate through, and nor do they pay taxes, or probably they probably don't even use money.
Well, I don't think they'd have any respect. I've seen, this one person was saying, he estimates the Rothschilds' net worth at like $150 trillion. That would indicate that their net worth is zero, because the the dollars would have no meaning. You see? So they don't. The person who makes this charge is actually a victim and has been mesmerized by this concept of dollar.
That's Forbes' list of the world's richest people or something, right?
It's like
Bill Gates or someone. You laugh to laugh at that, right?
Yeah,
but they don't count it. I mean, they have control of countries and resources and governments, which. Lock on. I mean, a lot of the, I would say even a lot of the properties that are reserved essentially for the environment are ultimately probably controlled by the Rothschilds. And that's what the World Wildlife Federation was about, you know,
right. And their minions, because remember, the Rothschilds is a vast, you know, it's like it isn't just this one little family. I mean, they're inbred completely with the Warburgs and the Schiffs and the Loebs. I mean, they have this long banking family inbreeding. I mean, like Disraeli was a Rothschild, for example.
And they married into the aristocracy. So they
And then who was like Perry, who brought Freemasonry to Japan? I mean, wasn't he? I think he was a Rothschild as well. I mean,
yeah, he was. His daughter married. Belmont, who was a suspected to be an illegitimate son of the Rothschilds. Right. I think.
So you've got this Jewish banking family that's pretty vast, and I think it has a really good understanding of the nature of money. Money is a tool of control and power.
Yeah.
It's not really a store of wealth. That is the way that people are controlled, you know. And so, I've said over and over again, it's like, you know, people, they get confused by the dialectic, you know, capitalism, socialism, you know, like what is good, what is bad. Look, it doesn't matter what the nature of the system is. All that really matters is the nature of the individuals who are in control. Mm-hmm. They can make either side, either part of the dialectic, win or lose. And so if you're involved in that struggle, you're missing the point. You just have to stop looking at the puppets and the drama and just pay attention to the strings.
Well, you just look at financial warfare and how the system is rigged. That gets you on the... on the treadmill, where you just to keep up, you don't have much time to think critically about the system or even challenge it, or much less even a conscious thought about it. And that's a way, that's that one of these sophisticated forms of slavery that they've imposed upon us. They got away, you know, they could do away with chattel slavery because they're no longer paid, and they had wage slavery. Then, you know, you could tap into the Irish cheap labor. Then when that was done, you could tap into Latin America or cheap labor from Asia, and they had the ability to, you know, to topple governments or destabilize entire continents. And this creates a vast pool of cheap labor decades later. It also creates access to natural resources or prevents competition from those resources from being developed. If there was a free market, you'd have competing, you know, agents or factions developing those resources and dumping them onto the market. And but all these wars we've seen, and that's why you can look at a lot of the wars of the 20th century, was an attempt to do that. And that's, you know, that's why you can't look at any economies being free versus, you know, capitalism versus socialism, because all economies at one level are manipulated or planned, you know. So
That's right. And so it's a you know, so it's interesting. I was like, the thought that came to me, you know, seeing the prescience in this thing, you know, and seeing how I saw it as just kind of a subtle mind control, part of the subtle mind control thing. And the question was, well, what is really rebellion? You know, I don't know if you ever read Camus' book, The Rebel, but, you know, he talks about all these categories of rebellion, you know, metaphysical rebellion, spiritual rebellion, political rebellion, you know, and I was thinking, well, what is a, rebel from the New World Order, you know, what would that be? Mm-hmm. And you know what really rebellion is, what they think they really are the most afraid of is just thought. If people start thinking and actually just saying, you know, I just cannot buy the historical narrative, I'm going to start just thinking about it. If that started becoming a trend, if you started to like have like a party based on thought, you know, it's like we're just thinkers. That's all we are. We're the thinking party. You know, and they actually would just try to look at the political control, you know, through thought process. I think that would actually be what would shake them up. That would be the thing that would probably be that they'd have to act really fast in order to stop it. Because if that became a habit and a fad, that we were going to rethink the whole nature of the historical narrative, the nature of the motivations of the people who are, you know, claiming to be honest actors in politics, like Trump and Hillary. if we were just, we just became skeptical about everything, we would get to the point of like where Cass Sunstein, you know, would say, democracy is not working. You know, it's like no one believes that, you don't believe it, we're sincere, you know. That would be a way to rebel. And that's something that we can actually do. We just have to, you know, use our moment in time here with the internet to make people aware of the possibility that the whole historical narrative has been faked for the purpose of mind control.
Well, that's what Brzezinski worried about not too long ago, about a public awakening, mass consciousness, general consciousness about the system itself. I think this was the early 2000s. And, you know, other people have written about this. I think it was Sammy Huntington who called it the crisis of democracy, when people were becoming too aware of the illegitimacy of the system. And this is why the war on thought, and it goes to the first step in a war on thought is the war on language, the meaning of word, which goes back to 1984 and, you know, the whole thing about 2 + 2 = 4, demanding that that he say that it's 5. You know, of course, the idea there is that, you know, if there's objective truth, objective truth is more powerful than the party. And the idea is to break your will so you actually do believe that 2 + 2 = 5. And when you do that, the party wins. And we're seeing that today. I mean, a lot of what we're seeing with the sort of transgenderism and LGBTQ plus whatever is not only is it advanced, you know, degeneration of society, moral decay that's being promoted, you know, by these groups. It's also an ability to destroy, you know, conscious or rational thought, meaning that, you know, the words have actual relation to reality. And when words have accurate relation to reality, we can have dialogue and debate. But if words lose their meaning, you know, whereas pronouns and these things can be interchangeable, and a man simply can imagine himself to be a woman, and a woman can imagine herself to be a man, these things, then there is no clear thought anymore. And then we are all just left befuddled, confused, and we'll just be atomized and, okay, I'll say anything, just leave me alone. You know, that's why you have this thing like on Facebook and social media and at work, where if you do say something skeptical or critical of some transvestite, you know, degenerate weirdo pervert, all of a sudden now that's grounds for termination or at least.
That's why our show is censored by YouTube.
Yeah.
I mean, look at how they go out of their way to basically pull the plug on every single show that, you know, talks about anything. And talks about analytically, right? So they center it. Well, I mean, now the battle is drawn. You know, it's the idea of thinking and analyzing versus the power of the party. Mm-hmm. To basically 2 + 2 = 5. You know, there is no powers and principalities. It's off the air.
Yeah.
So that's just how they're able to keep moving the ball forward. But we have to hope and we have to try to actually create this this revolution in consciousness.
Well, it's funny, you think you could embarrass them. So you don't believe in free speech? What are you afraid of? Afraid of debating? And yet they're not embarrassed at all, are they?
No, it's just the power. I mean, they couldn't, obviously. They would just be impossible, you know. And it's like... now they have on Facebook, they have this kind of censor that follows articles around. If you have a vaccine, you know, article that you post on your Facebook page, suddenly this refutation will pop up.
Yeah.
You know? And it'll say, no, we know the truth about this, you know. But they don't invite the individual who made the post or who created the verbiage to enter into an exchange. They just put out a stamp of mind control over the top of it.
Yeah, YouTube started doing that too with if anything like JFK assassination in the title, and it was discussing the various competing theories about the true nature of the assassination. Being skeptical of the official narrative, there'll be this disclaimer telling you what the official narrative is. That's true.
Yeah.
Insulting everyone's intelligence. I mean, it's like, really? You got to put like a Wikipedia type, synopsis of what the official narrative is? you know, for fear. And does that really turn anyone away? I mean, I don't know if they're still doing that or not, but I think now they're just taking anything off, you know.
Yeah, and then so okay, but just contrast that with the prescient ideas expressed in the report in Iron Mountain. At the end, page 62, you know, he has like the different categories of what they came up with in their little think tank, and he has economic. A comprehensive social welfare program directed toward maximum improvement and control over the general conditions of human life, a giant open-end space research program aimed at unreachable targets, a permanent ritualized ultra-elaborate disarmament inspection system and variants of such a system, political goals. We need an omnipotent, virtually omnipotent international police force. Wow. An established and recognized extraterrestrial menace, massive global environmental pollution. Remember, this is written in 60, probably writing in 65.
Yeah.
And then fictitious alternative enemies. You know, so
that's, I think this is 5 years before the first Earth Day or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is pretty sophisticated, prescient, you know, kind of stuff.
But the Club of Rome was what, 4 years later?
Yeah. That's right.
Club of Rome is similar too to this, yeah.
Yeah, very much. And I think you can see that the programs were kind of already, you know, the insiders knew it. And so in the motivational function, he goes, intensified environmental pollution, new religions and other mythologies, socially oriented blood games.
Yeah, the textbook, sports and game shows and
yeah.
Even pornography, I think, right?
What about MMA wrestling?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's
women MMA fighters?
Yeah, women, yes, you know, and being given tremendous praise for, like, you know, like how they could take a punch and bleed out of both eyeballs.
I remember that purportedly it's becoming popular. I don't know how actually popular it is, but I'm being told that it is. And I'm seeing these reports about these women beating each other up. Is this something you want to see? I mean, well, boxing is, male boxing itself is problematic in and of itself, but geez, this is really disgusting.
Well, it is disgusting, and it's just done to debase women so that they can become basically masculinized,
yeah.
You know, in the new kind of brave new world sexuality.
Well, that's it, because with male pugilism, it's almost like, you know, in the ring you win, and this is some expression of what's expected properly of males, so to defend, whereas with women it's a corruption, it's a defilement. Yeah, it's worse. Yeah, just like women in combat's bad in and of itself, but throwing women in combat just for the sake of throwing women in the combat scenarios is just a further declination, I think. Yeah.
And then to like justify it on the grounds of equality. I mean, it's just, it's God almighty, you know, this is, yeah. So
like when you have like a sporting event and there's a president there and there's a woman there with two titanium false legs, and we're supposed to be proud of that.
Yeah.
No.
And that happens almost every single time where they've got the, you know, the flipper humans that come out, mm-hmm. And they have them, you know, like on these commercials. They'll have like heroes, you know, like someone who wins a race, but they'll always throw in someone with one of those spring-loaded legs hopping along, you know. And it just they're I mean, you know, sad to say, and I mean, for heaven's sakes, those individuals are worth all of our sympathy and mercy, but they should not be put out as role models.
No.
See, I mean, this is what we want to avoid. This should not be normalized. We don't want to have a society whereby we give up our children to the state and let them lop off their limbs and send them back to us with these, gears on them.
Did you ever see there's a movie a while back, about 20, a little more than 20 years ago, called Starship Troopers, Hyland's book? But
oh, yeah.
The bug planet and all that. There's a scene in it where the bugs have attacked Earth and everyone's signing up to go. And this guy's signing up in the armed forces, and he's in the infantry, and he's in line. He comes up to the guy enlisting him, and there's a guy there sitting down. He's missing both legs, one arm, has a mechanical arm, and one healthy arm. And he goes, "Infantry, all right, young man. Infantry made me the man I am today." And he looks at him.
Heinlein was who wrote the book, you know, was like a Laurel Canyon Masonic cesspool character. But there it is. You know, they're just trying to make the sacrifice of self like a noble thing. It's sort of like my favorite, actually, kind of Masonic cesspool poem is The Charge of the Light Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
There's not to reason why.
Yes.
There's not to do and die. Someone had blundered, you know, volleys to the left of them, volleys to the right of them, on road to 600, you know, they all got killed. Well, yeah, the Masons thought this was great, and they wanted to make sure that the public thought this was heroic so they could continue to send sons forward for sacrifice.
Yes, yeah. That's where they look at something like the Christmas truce in 1914 is so that really, I think that really sent shockwaves, and they had to stop that because imagine peace breaking out. That's a tragedy.
The Christmas truce was the greatest rebellion that and the most praiseworthy human moment we've ever had. And if only it had spread and those soldiers had realized that the enemy wasn't across the line. It was in back of them and turned.
Well, it's interesting that I didn't hear about it until my early adulthood. It's not, you'll hear about, the Battle of Belleau Wood or the Argonne Forest. You hear about D-Day or, heroics of the Battle of the Bulge and, saying nuts to the Germans and these things. But you didn't hear about this war story.
Yeah, and I know, and it means actually something. It's strange, it's in our memory to some extent. My grandfather was in World War I and was mustard gassed. Arthur Fallows, and he was a poet, really wonderful kind of guy, as far as anyone knows. But he suffered from lung disease for the next 40 years. He never had a healthy day after being mustard gassed, and he was one of the lucky ones. I think like 60% of the people in his division were killed.
But Joe, if you didn't have mustard gas, you wouldn't have chemotherapy today. So.
I know, that's right. That's right. I mean, we've come such a long way. So it's the report on Iron Mountain. I hope that people, the right or whoever it is who is bringing it forward as Agenda 21, would rethink it. And it is kind of Agenda 21, but they should try to understand it as they should try to understand the concept of foreshadowing.
Yeah, and also there's a lot of other literature out there. I mean, you can read about the Nye Committee and the investigations of the Merchants of Death in the interwar period, 1920s and 30s. There's an interesting, monograph by Murray Rothbard called Wall Street, and the Wall Street, the banks and the war, or something like that. It talks about these financial connections. And so inform yourself on that. Everyone's familiar with Eisenhower, the military industrial complex. That's a later revelation. But there's Anthony Sutton's work,
it's kind of a shame. I'm actually hoping to maybe make a contribution in this area, but there really isn't a good book that just details the flat fact of population reduction as the real purpose. You know, you have all of these ideas about money and bankers, they're ahead of the curve. You read about the Rothschilds getting information about the Battle of Waterloo and making mm-hmm. In the futures market, and that this somehow is like, that because they're funding, that this is, it's a way to make money. Look, bear in mind what we were talking about earlier. Money is nothing to them. They invent this stuff. They can invent more of it if they need more. They use it as control for a purpose. And the purpose is supersession and population reduction.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you see like the war going on, like the Napoleonic War, there's no doubt there's bankers making money on both sides of the deal, but that isn't the real, deep purpose for it. It is for population control and for reduction, and then of course with the fake historical narrative, then to control the people who remain. And so, you know, when you get to this character who's ever writing the Report on Iron Mountain, I mean, you know, you've had hundreds of years of tricking the public into these programs, right? He's looking at the future, and they're a little more articulated, a little more, you know, technologic as he's looking forward. But this is the same crap that was occurring in the 17th, 18th. I mean, you know, he talks about, you know, new religions and other mythologies. Think of the kind of crackpot mythology that was being spun around in the 18th century by Palmerston's Freemason crews throughout Europe.
Yes.
I mean, just think about, like, you know, the Quattro Coronati and all of this damn.
And then you have sort of the corruption of existing religions, like you get with the Scofield Bible.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And it's all working toward just a atomized individual with no real kind of basis to resist the new world order, you know, that is coming on fast. And so this is the thing, is that, you know, the people should be angry about this thing, not because, you know, it's a real political document that was somehow leaked out. And then, you know, it's because the people who created it are laughing at us. You know, they know the truth. They know these programs are all being established, and they know that when they come forward and say, hey, it's just a joke, man. It's just a joke. It's a satire. We're too stupid to recognize that it's a mockery of our idiocy.
It's almost similar. Remember, what was that thing in 1974, the changing images of man?
Yeah.
Which focused more on the cultural, you know, shift that was occurring.
I mean, this is from like an MKUltra spook shrink. Who was doing programs or like experiments with low frequency energy to see if he could like condition people to do what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was writing changing images of man on one hand about, well, we're going to be this brave new, you know, individual with all this creative freedom and stuff. And on the other hand, he was learning how to like turn people into mechanical robots.
Yep.
with the MKUltra program. I mean, it's just ridiculous, you know? So we get the changing image of man, but on back of that, you get the low frequency radio technology so that they can make us frightened, you know, whenever they want, you know, which is really one of the things that MKUltra was trying to come up with, was just how to scare us, you know, and whenever they wanted. And that's why, you know, we should talk sometime about 5G.
Yeah, it might be, yeah, something like that. Yeah,
that's, you know, it's very, you know, I smell a rat. So, you know, so anyway, it's like, you know, so I don't know. I mean, I hope we've done some use here as far as like, you know, pushing at least the idea that, you know, something, when you come across the Iron Mountain Report, you should think about this.
Yeah.
You know, what is it? Where does it come from? What is the motivation of the people? How do you explain the prescient understandings, you know? And if you get into that, then I think you'll pretty clearly come up with an understanding of, well, who put it out? What was their real meaning for it? You know, why does it bamboozle us to this very day? Just like the protocols.
Yeah. You know? And again, if you look at it, it's dismissed as a hoax and you're saying, yeah, this is just conspiracy theory hoax. It isn't that simple. Then you point out that everything it's calling for is being done or has been done.
Right. And he could have known about it back in 65 and 66 when he was writing this thing. So the program was, you know, these ideas were being thought of. They were being, you know, formed. The technology was being created. A modern, sophisticated form of slavery modeled on the Peace Corps model. I mean, you know, yeah, I get it. This guy was a real filthy lifetime actor who presents himself. You know, I don't know this Lewin guy. Now, there's not really much known about him. I tried to see if he was related to Kurt Lewin, the Frankfurt School guy, and I couldn't get any connection. But his family seems to, his Lewin clan seems to have been in the U.S. before Kurt showed up, like after World War I. But it's the same thing, man. It's the Frankfurt School. It's just, you know, the chapter 23 of the authoritarian personality,
yeah,
where they get to use every imaginable kind of propaganda, particularly Eros, to shape us into what they can easily control. You know?
Mm-hmm. So. Okay, Joe, think we covered it?
All right, well, I think so. It was a lot of fun, and we'll get them next week, okay?
Enjoy your weekend.
All right, brother. You too.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.